Hey guys, it's Alec. Just wanted to get a quick preamble in before we pivot over to the live audio from this very special live episode of Crypto Voices. For context, we were interviewing Dr. David Shum at his XX Protocol event in Austin, Texas last week. It was on the rooftop of the Line Hotel. And if you weren't aware, last week was consensus in Austin. There were, I'm told, 17,000 attendees to the conference proper and probably many more that were just in town to be part of all the crypto events. And so this is a great conversation, lots of talk about surveillance, privacy, government, and what we can do to, you know, hedge oppression. Quick shout out to Joe Hunt and Celia Black and Rachel Pippin for helping make this come together. Obviously support from Keto and Matthew on the event. And there was a very special privacy friend in the background that linked us all up. And so thanks to that Anon person as well. Hope you guys enjoy. So welcome everyone. I think this is our first ever live episode of Crypto Voices. It's going to be episode 128. Fantastic to be in the room with friends and fellow privacy nut jobs. So we're going to dive right in, get some questions with David on the topic of privacy and XX Network. And I will just start with a difficult one. So the ad tech industry, data brokers, etc. They are collecting on us every tap, swipe, everything we do on the internet, every app we have. And that industry writ large in the US is valued at three times that of the IC community, the Intel community in the US. And so who's worse, the data brokers or the NSA and the Intel community?
It's a tough call. I think they work together in more ways than are obvious. Obviously, and you know, it's the whole. There are other forces as well that are often disregarded and ignored because you know, a tremendous amount of information about everybody, probably everybody here, has been liberated from the companies that captured it. Whether they really legitimately should have captured it or owned it or whatever, that's another question. But they may be selling it, on all kinds of platforms and using it in all kinds of ways. And so, one of the things that you have to also keep in mind is that information about individuals, it has a continuing residual value. It's not likely to ever disappear. And so it's all kind of floating around and accumulating and circulating and being, resold and hoarded. And I think if you'd keep the growth of AI's current capabilities in mind, it's not going to be long before all that stuff can be, kind of synthesized and unified at a low cost, and so it's a pretty serious exposure. Yeah, so it's a whole, once data leaks, it's out there forever, and then it just, it's, so I think, I was shocked. I came back into this when I, read the Snowden disclosures, and then I went to the crypto conference, that's a series of conferences that I founded, so like 30 years ago, the conferences on cryptography proper, and there's three each year. And I went to the flagship event a couple months after the Snowden revelations, and I was shocked that all of my, 700 colleagues, many of which I know for years in the field, weren't really, shocked by this. They weren't. They hardly cared. I was like the most surprised by it, and they all thought I wouldn't be surprised because they always felt that I was the one who was most suspicious of the government, So I had founded this organization because the government said you couldn't do public conferences on cryptography, and they would put you in jail if you did. So that's when I decided to have a public conference on cryptography. And, you know, set cryptography free by founding the International Association for Cryptologic Research. So, yeah. Anyways, it's yeah.
These are great things. So let me go a little further then. So I typically think of cryptography as a way for someone to hedge against the power of grading themselves. But do governments deserve quantum proof cryptography too?
So there's recently a presidential directive in the U.S. that all government agencies should use, in effect, the strongest type of quantum secure cryptography to protect all of their VPN content. I think immediately, if I read it correctly. And, you know, it's just beyond comprehension, really, how the U.S. government, for example, but I suppose it's quite similar in a lot of countries, is so extremely secretive about everything they do. And that secrecy is, I think, illegal because it's not really, it's precluded under the law. They just routinely classify everything pretty much, and they never declassify stuff. And when they do, that you know, they redact it and so on, and you never know how much of that's real and how much is misinformation. So by that time, it's pretty much useless. It's stunning. On the other hand, they seem to want to know everything about us, right? They seem to have the right, not only, I was actually once again shocked, just a couple weeks ago, I was reading that the U.S. government feels that they have the right to adopt the identities of individuals and masquerade as them in their online presence. Yeah, it's quite stunning, and this is done for various reasons, and you know, I can't give all the qualifications, but something like that is extraordinarily damaging to any hope for democracy, because you don't even know who, you know, the people are anymore, and who can imagine what kind of trouble they're causing and what kind of things they, you know, incite and foment and entrap and make up, and you know, and there's a whole long history of it's now become known that the, you know, the U.S. government does not reveal that they spied on people, but they tip off law enforcement and so on in ways that can't be tied back to them, so that people are mysteriously arrested under very surprising circumstances. And you know, this is it's just a craziness. So the asymmetry, which has been, you know, stunning forever, for the longest time, say in the U.S., I could say that for sure, it's just gone now to, you know, further extreme reaches that are just, yeah, just hard to imagine. So I'll say one final thing is that I'm absolutely certain that the only way to reinvigorate the institutions of democracy in this country, for instance, to recreate faith in institutions, to make democracy actually function again, is to completely turn the tables and have transparency of governance and a individually protected, enforced privacy of your own information.
Yeah, agreed. So we'll give the government a break. I pivot. So one of the issues in secure communications is that you have to encrypt the content, but then you also have to think about the links between people who are communicating, the attribution of their devices. It's more than just an encrypted message. And so the example I always give is, if I were to call my oncologist on Signal once a week for a month, you don't need to break into that message to kind of figure out what's going on. So there's other things around messaging that are important. I think that gets at what you guys are doing at XX. So can you speak to the attribution and the link analysis and the metadata?
So when I was at Berkeley as a grad student, I think the volume's a little high, but it sounds a bit better. You know, one of the things that I found out about was that in the military intelligence world, right, and spying by governments generally, they were most interested in and made the most use of what's called traffic analysis data in their parlance. And now I think Obama renamed this euphemistically metadata, which is the same things, you know, that your photographs have. There's a lot of metadata that's kind of sort of diluted the meaning, but traffic analysis is the technical term. And of course, traffic analysis data does not lie. People can speak in code. They can try to mislead others who are listening in and so forth and so on. But traffic data is a kind of gold standard that is also compact enough that you can really analyze it. And so I went over to the Berkeley, I went over to the Doe Library, the main library, and they have the congressional record there. That they were one of the few places that had the whole sworn testimony in these books. And I was reading about the, it turned out that when the United States decided, and I think Tomas is here from Chile. There he is. Yeah, thanks for coming. He's running some of our nodes in Chile, and a long-time friend of mine. But I hate to bring this up, but there was a little bit of ugliness that occurred there in, I think it was 72. And, so the Congress was given one question to the CIA about their covert ops back in the day. So they said, oh, tell us about how you took over Chile. And so it's in the congressional record what the CIA said about how they did it. And the way they did it was they compromised the phone central at the embassy, at the presidential, the center of government there. And they just made it record who called who and when and for how long. And then every night it would upload this to an unlisted number in Washington, D.C. And that was, you know, pretty primitive technology, but that was an easy hack, I guess. And then they paid universities and other people to analyze this data, and they figured out who was really running the country. You know, because you could tell, like, who contacted who before and after certain events and so on and so forth. And so then they were able just to go in there and basically, take over the country with very little bloodshed. And so that's an example of traffic analysis data. So I'll just say one other thing, we have Serotonin here, who's been helping us with the, and Rachel, and actually Tomas, and Latin America, and we have a number of other partners around the world helping us get our message out. And what we have found consistently is that, you know, the public understands encryption of message content. And that's the thing that all these networks talk about, and they talk about the strong encryption of the, you know, the message content. However, of course, we're the only ones that have a quantum-resistant encryption of message content, and no content has caught up with us. So that's rather stunning. So I think that shows they aren't really, watching everyone's, got everyone's back in terms of that. It's a kind of fake, because what they're really doing is distracting the public's attention from the real issue, which is traffic analysis. None of the other messengers has it, a protection against it. We have it, and we are, with all our efforts, we found it very difficult to explain it to the public. And but it is really the fundamental thing, because if you can't protect the traffic data, then, you know, your privacy is pretty much lost at that point. So we're, you know, one of the things that we've done is that's finally turned the tide on this. It's really exciting to see that in our messenger, every message that you send or receive, you can click on a little icon there, and it will show you the five nodes around the world that your message has traveled through. And that when people see that for their own messages, all of a sudden they get it and they love it. Yeah, until that moment, metadata and traffic analysis is like something that just goes over people's heads, you know? I mean, there is a long-standing historical phenomena that people basically tend to discount really big issues in public policy until things really crater. And we see that all around these days with global warming and everything else, right? It's very little is done until it just gets to be unbearable. And so that, I think, is a bit of that in the traffic laws. But I think it's also the people just don't understand how invasive that is, how useful it is, and how pervasive it is. You know, it used to be, I think it's still legal in the United States for the government to weigh and write down all the addresses on all paper mail you send and receive. And then for telephone conversations, there's what's called a pen register. Any government agency can request it, and that is every number that you call and every number that calls you and how long the call lasts. That's not considered information that government agencies shouldn't be able to just get by asking for it.
Yeah.
That's traffic data. That's because the public is not aware of the significance of this.
Yeah, this is super important. So what's the difference between quantum proof, quantum resistant, post-quantum? Are those the same thing, different? Where are you guys?
Well, there's another, you know, thing that's been happening over the last couple decades where the National Security Agency has been caught from time to time building in trapdoors and weaknesses into various cryptographic algorithms. They were even caught paying money, $10 million, to bribe some company to put in a weaker key generation system. It's a company, the founders of which I happen to know, so I don't know the exact story behind that, but this is kind of parallel with an effort where the so-called National Institute of Standards, the United States, allegedly promulgates these open competitions for cryptographic algorithms. Well, you know, I know the people who run that, and I know some of these people, the agency and so on, and basically what happens is the agency is the one who makes the final decisions on the parameters and the choices of the winners. It's not really the NIST, you know, so there's a whole fraudulent scheme to try to get industry to use weak cryptography that has weaknesses that they think they can exploit and other people can't. You know, I was personally involved with this. If you can believe it, I was a consultant to a Fortune 500 company that sent me all around the world with a group of handlers, you know, fortunately, because some of these situations have got a little bit scary, but, you know, I was supposed to, like, look at these cryptographic algorithms that were being offered for sale to protect commercial data, and the truth is, of the four that I was asked to evaluate, I was able to break all four. And in one of the cases, I found out it was a company that was owned now, two of the companies, it turned out, were owned by the CIA in Switzerland. The two big companies,
Crypto
the most
AG.
Famous companies, Crypto AG and Greytag. And I broke both of their systems. And so I didn't even know that those guys were CIA guys that I was talking to. But, you know, fortunately, I got out of town. Unscathed, but you know, it was one of them. I could tell you stories about this all day long. And another one was a company called Datotech, right here in Texas. And I knew their chief cryptographer. He used to come to the conferences. He was a friend of mine, and you know, he's a math professor. And you know, I mean, I could break that thing. You know, as we say, the trade up one side and down the other. You know, it was shocking. So. A friend of mine who is not really in the intelligence community, but sort of like, he sent me these photos and stuff and showed me that Datotech was being used in Nicaragua. So when, you know, the U.S. government says, oh, here's some money to buy some military gear, but you have to buy it from U.S. companies, Datotech for your crypto gear. Well, yeah. I can tell you that the Datotech also made these, you know, everything that was said over that gear was, like, picked up immediately, but not, but, you know, only by, but
sir,
as the whole thing. So, anyways, yeah, it's just a crazy, with respect to quantum cryptography, it's not any different. I'll just call it fake quantum secure, which is really, it's sort of quantum secure, but there's another algorithm in there that you could break, mm-hmm. and that's what the NSA has been promoting, and they you know, it's kind of blown up in their face a little bit recently, but that doesn't stop them. And then there's like the kind of stuff that U.S. government says that all the agencies have to use. That's the real quantum resistance. That's the strongest kind of cryptography there is, basically. And so it's based on what you might call, you know, it sounds kind of backwards, but with the weakest possible assumptions. In other words, it's the strongest kind of cryptography. It's based on fully random functions. And that's what people who really know what's really going on, that's what they want. And the wider those functions are, the better chance you can stop a quantum computer from breaking them, because it, anyway, so that's what we use at XX. We're not, you know, taken in by this kind of stuff. So there's just, it's, you know, it's like, it's not really how it appears, this whole industry.
Agreed. So we've talked a lot about cryptography from the standpoint of secrecy, protecting people, privacy. Is cryptography also a force for transparency?
So this is another aspect of cryptography that's not widely understood, but it's really extraordinarily powerful stuff, because not only can it protect the secrecy of information, but it can prove the correctness of partial information about those protected secrets. And it can do that in arbitrarily complex ways, however you want to. And that sounds very abstract, but what it means in practice is, like, you don't have to show your ID in order to convince someone that you're qualified to, you know, go to this bar or drive this car or whatever. Prove that you have insurance or live in the state or you're the right age or whatever without revealing, you know, all kinds of other information about yourself. That's what I call a credential mechanism. That's an example of the true power of cryptography to, you know, once you protect all the sensitive data, then you can be as transparent about all the aspects of that data that you want to be transparent about, that the people who control the data by owning their own keys agree to allow to become public. But it doesn't just become public like current data about people, but its veracity is proven.
Yeah, so actually that leads into, what would a zero knowledge future look like, and is there a dystopian version of zero knowledge?
The real question is, what are we trying to use information technology to achieve? And if we use it in a way that is controlled by the public, in other words, we can use it to amplify democracy and to make democracy work in a very effective, transparent, and efficient, very fair, and liberty-providing ways to increase prosperity. That's kind of the thesis I've been pursuing, and it looks, I'm prepared to defend that. I don't see the way through to make that happen. So, it's far from, I mean, I suppose any technology could be used in a bad way, but the amazing thing is that the kind of stuff we're doing here with Web3 and, I guess, the XX platform, which you'll hear about, for privacy, it is the foundational basis for democracy. You know, you can't have, I think it's the last question, is that right?
Please, yeah.
So just a closing note, I mean, you cannot help people by solving part of their privacy problem. You have to solve the whole problem, because otherwise you're just painting a big red target on their back, right? So in order to solve the whole problem, it's not really that difficult. And I can publish about this in Scientific American, and it's all you need is privacy of who you talk to, privacy of who you pay and pays you, and what I've called the credential mechanism, which is this kind of zero-knowledge based way to show the truthfulness of your statements about yourself that are based on, like, digitally signed credentials that you receive from the powers that be. And those three things, and with a little bit of an extra twist, which is the inalienable privacy, so I'm not going to go into that here, but watch this space, we're there. And with that, you can, create a AI-proof paradise on Earth, and I can see a way through to do that, and the first step is XX Network.
So we'll close on AI paradise, AI-proof paradise on Earth. That's a good sentiment. Thank you, guys. Thank you, David. Pleasure having you.
Hey, it was great.
Cheers.
Thanks, Paul.